goes around the whole, I mean, wall that goes around the whole village. And inside that, you walk in, first place, you gotta be feel real nice about water buffalo and cows, and because they're all over the lot. The people, well, I guess you would be most impressed with the fact of how much people live outdoors. They have to have shelter from rain, and they have to have shelter from the very hot sun. Usually there'd be a huge big tree called the banyan tree in the middle, kind of in the center of this village. And lots of people just sitting down. You know how to sit down on your haunches? Do you? I can't do it for you, but that's the way Indian people sit by the hour and talk. And the old men are very, and the women too, are very, very much respected. Then around the little alleyways and lanes and along these are houses, not separate usually, right side by side. And you would, any one of you, I think, would really be shocked. And if you went to an Indian village, you'd probably sort of hold your nose because of all the animals and the excreta of the animals, and it all looks terrible to you. But if you had been there 10 years ago, you'd think it was fine, because there was hardly a village in India that had a closed sewer, a covered drain. Most of them didn't even have latrines. They never had brick in the little lanes. There was thick mud in the wet weather and awfully dusty in the hot weather. And in most of the villages where they had a really good, one of these cooperative Gandhian-type development things going, they've got brick in the little lanes, and they've got covered drains, and they've built latrines. And something simple, what do you think about, you know, people talk about these underdeveloped areas that, you know, gotta develop, and lots of Americans begin to think they've gotta have machines, and they've gotta have all the things we have, and this is not what they need. Many of the old villages used to have in their homes these little stoves with no stovepipe, and it would just blind you to go in, you know, smoke all over the place. So now they build what they call a smokeless chula. It's nothing, it's not difficult to do at all. And yet, that is one of the biggest improvements you can imagine. The water they usually get from a well, and here again, you might look and see, here are all these poor women pulling up great pots of water and putting them on their heads and walking off. Oh, that's pretty hard work. Well, it is, but in the old days, they didn't even have a paved area around the well. And so all the dirt would fall back into the well, and that's how disease spread. And now they have things really clean. I mean, clean doesn't look clean to you, but it is. It's so much better. Now, do you want to decide who gets
caught? George?
Oh, I've
been
to my job.
Yeah? Well, they use a little more thatch there, you know, thatch roof. But usually the walls are the same. But and the same type of village agglomeration of people. The population is much greater in Madras and the southern parts of India. When we drove down the west coast, and it's now called Kerala. It used to be Travancore and so on. And you really think, well, where's the end of this village? You never end. You just go from one to another.
Across the
great, great overpopulation, making it so hard for the people to get enough to eat or to water or any of the things they need. This is one of them. And I think Madras, it's one of the people who live there. It's kind of, you know, everybody has a local pride. We have in the United States, you know, how the Texans think they're just the greatest people. And people from Massachusetts think they're fine. People from California think they're great. Well, in India, it's far more marked because the differences between Madras in Delhi, are very much greater. And the southern people, that is the Madrasis, are inclined to think that they're neglected. It's kind of interesting because I think our southern people think they're neglected too. They have a most wonderful culture. This is true. Really marvelous. They've had some of the greatest writers, some of the greatest philosophers of any part of India. But the village life is just about the same. And they have the same problems. Or not, they, you know, the way they get water or irrigate their fields, gradually they're getting power, diesel engines, which is wonderful for them. And they just get a pump going, and it just transforms the village. As it is, before they get the engine, they may have a camel or a bullock. You know the Persian wheel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, going round and round and round and round, and the endless belt of little buckets brings up water and spills it into a little ditch, and then it goes out onto the fields. But this is pretty slow growing. Another way they do, which looks awful hard to me, is that they want to get water from the places down here, up into this field. They have a long pole with a huge, I think it's a skin bucket, not a real metal bucket, and it gets full, and then the fellow walks down the pole all the way and gets the thing lifted up and pours it into the field. You just can't, this is the thing I think I had the hardest time learning myself.
Like a seesaw, you mean?
Yes, but the speed, the kind of thing, we think everything has to go quicker. Well, India wants to move faster, but locomotion by bicycle is fantastic. That's just the greatest thing that can happen to you if you get a bicycle. Some of the nurses from the Delhi School of Nursing, this is in my daughter's book, Cynthia's book. If you read her book on Chawla, read that part on the village of Chawla again, and you'll get an awfully much better idea than I can give you here. The nurses out there, the women of the American women in Delhi wanted to give these nurses a gift, just something to make their work easier. And the superintendent of the nurses said, "Oh my, they give me bicycles because they get a call in the middle of the night. Someone is having a baby, it's trouble, and she may have to walk 3 or 4 miles." Well, we gave them the bicycles, and this nurse came to thank the ladies. And she said, "Oh, you just can't imagine. Why, now they get a call, and they just zip off on their bicycles." We would think you ought to zip off in a car or something.
Ricky?
Well, could you describe a house in Mysore?
Well, I really, you know, I think the villages, except when you get up into the north country, like in Kashmir or Himachal Pradesh or up in Nepal. What are some of the other? Well, I'm sure Bhutan and Sikkim, I don't know those very well. I mean, I don't know them at all, frankly. But when you get up into the cold country where you have to have more shelter, then you have to have just a better house and less of this outdoor living, and also the materials around. I guess in those parts there's more wood. But down in the plains they just make use of the clay. But they have, that's one of the things that's come through the community development, cooperative brick making. Because you know that the clay houses are great, but they do kind of disintegrate in the rain.
Could you describe, is it an agricultural region?
Mysore? I don't know what it would be most known for. It's one of the most beautiful parts of India, and it's rather well known for its Maharaja. Have you heard about the Maharaja of Mysore? Well, he's still living, and he's a very forward-looking, progressive person who wants to do the best for his people. The Maharaja doesn't have any power like he had before independence, But if he wants to, he can be appointed, as he has been. I think they call him now Rajpravoks. And the living Maharajas, I don't know if you're interested in this, weren't there 125 princely states? Either that or 525. I mean, there are an awful lot of princely states that had allegiance to England. And at the time of independence, something had to be done with them. All the rest of India, obviously, was going to go as an independent nation. But what about these Maharajas? Well, I think it was the most really wonderful thing that they could persuade these people who had always ruled like kings in their little small kingdoms to give it up, which is what they did. They have been allowed by the government a certain stipend, a certain, I don't know how much money, for the rest of their lives, but then it's finished. So the thing doesn't go on anymore, and they don't have any power unless they get get appointed. This was always hereditary before.
Hazel?
What about East Pakistan? Well, I think it's just like, I've never been there, so perhaps I shouldn't say it so surely, but you know, East Pakistan was Bengal, the state of Bengal in India. And West Bengal remained in India, and East Bengal became Pakistan. So the people are exactly the same. And unhappily, there's still a terrific movement of refugees back and forth from those two areas. It's all over with in West Pakistan. But in East Pakistan, there's still unhappiness. Have any of you seen the movies Pathir Panchali and Aparajit and World of Apu?
They have not been playing since we've been studying, so we haven't been able to take it back.
So if that's Bengal, and really, you are, they're wonderful, wonderful pictures. And, you know, Hollywood, if it were a Hollywood picture, I wouldn't believe it. But if I didn't know Bengal, I wouldn't believe it. I just think it was an Indian type of Hollywood. Because it's very extreme, it's sad, it'll just make you die, and you feel so sorry for these poor people. But it's absolutely true. This is the way life is there. And I really think that'd be wonderful. I know the Asian Society has those available. I mean, you'd have to pay for it. Maybe you could have a famous school for a whole lot of people. Which one did you see? The World of Africa. Well, you remember that? And you know, there was a wealthy man in that, and he had a nice house. That's really just how a nice house would be. And it doesn't look very elaborate, does it? And going to any of these, in any of these Indian villages, there will be a house that will be pointed out to you, and they'll say, that's the wealthy man of the village. And I must say, it doesn't look like a very imposing house, but of course it is a lot better than the others. In the villages, there is still there's still a great deal of separation by caste, which you don't see in the cities. This is really sort of important if you're interested in village life. You can see, as you go into a village, I couldn't tell it myself, but people tell me, but here is where the weavers live, and all the weavers will live in one place. And here is where the leather workers are very low caste. Here's where the leather workers live. And then there is always a section of what are known as untouchables. And they do the very, very lowest form of work. And their homes are the worst, naturally. They're the poorest. But don't forget this, please, when you're thinking about CAST. Everywhere that the community development plan is working, it is illegal to have a well that is just for one caste. And you cannot say that an untouchable cannot come to your well. I mean, the well of the Brahmins and so on. Everybody has to share the well. Or they don't get any help in getting it made. Another thing is, and this is interesting to us on account of our own problem of integration in schools in the United States, note that every child goes to the same school. Now this is, just remember, this is village India. In Delhi and Bombay, you have all fine, very like private preparatory schools in this country. The English public school idea. But in a village, it's a village school and everybody goes. Now, people of different castes sometimes wear a different kind of clothing. And this makes it even worse, and you can easily tell who they are, and there's the so-and-sos, and there's the so-and-so. But I saw in a village in Delhi State, a new school had been started. Oh, and incidentally, you don't have to have very much in the way of building in India, because you don't have to keep warm. You're plenty warm to begin with. Here were the little girls. They do separate boys and girls, pretty much, even now. Here were the little girls, all with the same kind of dress. Oh, the little girls don't wear the sari. They wear a kind of a pantaloon, very, very full pants. They taper down the ankle. But around the waist, when you unstring it, really, it goes about like this. And then you tie it tight. It makes sort of baggy pants. And then a tunic, like a shirt.
We saw the picture Cynthia wore.
Well, that's what our girls wore to school when they were in India. It's only when the girls get to be, 17 or so, they begin to wear saris. Well, now, wait a minute. I was on the subject of, at this school, the girls were all dressed the same. I don't know whether it was just tunic and salwar, they call it, the pants, and kameez is the top. And they had their hair clean and braids. And I must say, to me, they looked all very much alike. And standing over the wall, looking over the wall, were their mothers. Simply, just overwhelmed at the sight of these girls all looking exactly the same. The mothers, each one had on a different type dress according to what caste she was. So these girls growing up in school are not going to fuss around much with caste when they grow up. And this is gradually changing throughout India. But I just want to make the point that it is slow and it's illegal. It's unconstitutional to discriminate on account of caste. But you know how long we've had in our constitution that it's illegal to discriminate on account of race, and we're still working it out.
Oh,
yeah.
Kara? Kara? Do you know about how many children they have in a class in India?
They're not crowded. That isn't the problem at all. I mean, I don't know why that is.
Well, in a village between 100 and 800 children.
Well, they don't all go. Actually, now 65% of the boys and girls between the age of 6 and 11 are in school in India. And this is twice as many as were there in school when we were there in 1952. Just can't believe the progress that they made. But it's slow. But these schools that I saw, really, this would be you call this, how many you got here?
20.
Well, I think it's between 20 and 30.
Jeff?
Well, is there a lot of poverty?
Oh, it's a terrible lot of poverty. That's just I think you all would really just feel so sad that the first time you arrive in an Indian city, you wouldn't feel quite so sad in an Indian village because you wouldn't be able to interpret how poor these people were. They look so pretty, and life in a village is very gay. There's a lot of dancing and music. And like I say, we go in and there's a big banyan tree and a lot of men sitting around on their haunches smoking these hookah pipes, you know, the long pipes that have water in the bottom. They're known as bubble pipes. And they pass the pipe around. It all looks kind of pleasant, but people are not even getting enough to eat. They're getting much better. And the death rate has, the life expectancy has gone up tremendously. I think it used to be the age, the average life expectancy was 26, and now it's 33 years, which is wonderful.
Jenny?
What's people's attitude
toward us? Oh, well, we thought they were very friendly. I know they were very friendly. And this is... I don't know, I think that the Indians, I don't know how many Indians you know. Do you have a chance to know any?
No, we haven't, and we hope to have a woman from Pakistan visit. She maybe it will come next week.
But you know, some of the Indian boys and girls who are here in New York would just love to come and see the Indian hostel, and yeah?
That's the kind of thing you would like to arrange, because...
Yeah.
This is what we're looking for. We had in our fifth grade a very wonderful thing that was arranged with Kathy of having some Greek children come here from a Greek American school. But
yes.
We would love to have some Indian children come and spend the day.
Just know there are a lot of with all these delegates here and the Indian consul. I would just be glad. I'm going to see the Indian consul. Next week, I haven't met him yet, but they say he's such a nice man. And, you know, just like if you were in their country, you'd love to meet them. At least this is what I know you would. That's the way our children were. And, our children were just about your ages. I mean, one was about this age, and then two girls, one girl 12, I guess, and one girl 14. And they were terrified. First, the idea of going to a new school, you know, even that's enough, let alone being in a new country. And they came home. The school was big. There were 1,500 children. And our children were, there were only 12 non-Indian children in that little school. And they came home and they were just happy. They had a good time. The Indians had all gathered around, oh, tell me about this and tell me about that. Of course, they have the weirdest ideas. They see our movie magazines, see all of our magazines, and that doesn't, you know, and they see our movies. That's the worst of all. They get the queerest ideas in part of their life.
I think we can't send television, did
we? Well, they are, and that's another thing. How hard it is to understand people of another country when they are getting their impressions of things which really aren't like us at all. But there's something I was going to ask you about.
I think Jenny would like to know a little bit more about their attitudes, just the ordinary Indians' attitude toward America as a whole. I mean, how did they feel about us?
When we went there in 51, it was not a very... At the top level, there was an awful lot of friction. And the Indians, I think they liked, the Indian government didn't like our government. There were a whole lot of diplomatic things that were wrong. But we never felt it personally. Another thing, I think you have to remember, we went one place that I bet they didn't know America existed. You know, I think they just think you're British if they see you're not Indian. But they're very friendly. And when Indians come here to visit, they tell me, they think this is the thing that Indians and Americans have most in common, is their cordiality and hospitality. There are practically no hotels in India except in the big cities. If you went to a small city, even if you went to a big city, you knew an Indian family, they wouldn't let you go and stay at a hotel by any means. very, very friendly. So generally, I think that's true. And I know the Peace Corps volunteers there have been having a wonderful reception. There's no feeling of antagonism to the Americans. That's a pretty big sweeping statement, but I really think that's right. Yeah, sure.
We have been reading him.
Oh.
Purposely to examine Mr. Kipling's bias and see what it is. And
well,
very curious.
I wanted to mention there probably is no one who has written so vividly about Indian bazaars, Indian villages as Kipling. I couldn't possibly describe a village as well as Kipling has done. The only thing wrong with Kipling is he had such outdated ideas. But his stories are charming, and they do give you an idea. There's just always that patronizing attitude of the wonderful British officer and the full Indian boy and the bazaar. You know, it just doesn't go anymore.
But they're very interested in finding out about the Barnum Wheel of Life, which we haven't been able to locate.
Oh, is this what's on the Indian flag?
The llama. The llama.
Oh.
The wheel of life. I think, yes, it is the, it is on the Indian flag.
Well, that's the, I think that's the Ashoka wheel, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, I can't tell you really
we'll have to
what its great significance is.
Jennifer?
They sure do. There's no place in the world that you don't hear Western music. But the Indian classical music, that's something you can really hear.
Yes.
And also, you can get, if we had only come from my home in Connecticut, I could have brought you good moving music. It sounds almost like South American music. But anyhow, there's just loads of music all over the place. Some of it's terrible because they have acquired these large speakers, and you know how everything sounds, how hard it sounds on a large speaker.
The one thing we haven't been able to find is a song, Indian songs.
Oh,
I. This is the area that. Music teacher would like very much to join. If you could give us the name of a publisher or a book that we can hunt down, because
then you want
to
sing yourself.
To learn some Indian song.
And you do know how to get records.
Oh yes,
yeah.
I've got records.
And musical instruments. Well, now they're most of them Indian musical instruments. Hard to play, except the flute. And again, when you talk about village life, you just never have an evening that you don't hear somebody playing the flute and drums. Everybody plays the drum. And it's not like African drums. I've been in Africa too. This is a much more musical and complicated kind of thing they do on the drums. Lots of dance. I just want to say one more thing about village life. Up to independence, I think 90% of the people were illiterate. And yet you go into a village, and today 60% are illiterate. And you go into a village today, and you find people don't read or write, but they're terribly cultured in the sense they know all of their classics. And why do they know? It's because they act them out on festival days. Everybody does. Everybody's in the act. And this is how they maintain their own culture so well. So many of the beautiful things of India are not in museums, but are right out there. I mean, the temples, and you must have heard of these the cave temples and the cave carvings and paintings of the Junta and the Laura. We had those pictures.
Yes, we have every National Geographic that has ever written an article about India.
One more thing I'd like to say about museums, because they are lovely. But there's been less of that collecting of things in museums. They're beginning now, I think perhaps because, the British took some away, and they're so much more interested in everyday beauty. And one of the loveliest things I have in my own possession, I think, is a little stone figure of Krishna about this big, and I paid 20 cents for it in the Stonecutter's Bazaar. They're constantly making figures of the gods and figures of their famous people, not famous people, but the people in the classics and in their stories. And then never mind if they lose them or break them, somebody's going to make one again. So I think more of their beauty is in everyday life than in the museums.
Mark?
Have you ever been to Salon?
Yes. That's a lot. Same.
Most of the things in Salon are the same as the things in New
York. Well, not. I'm sure they would resent that very much if I said, because they feel that they have very distinct national life. But they look a lot like South Indians. There's a whole very large Indian community in Ceylon. Indians who moved over from South India to go to work on the tea plantations. And they speak Tamil, which is the language of Madras. And the Ceylon people speak something else. It makes a real problem for their assimilation. But it's a beautiful. I'm trying to think. I don't think they're really any different. I think they're very much like the villages. I'm a little